Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps. I'm speaking about presentiment, which means feeling the future. And this is just one of the ways in which we seem to be influenced by things that happen in the future, particularly things that happen to us ourselves. Another way of experiencing this is through precognition, which means knowing the future, as in precognitive dreams, or premonitions, feeling warnings about the future. This is a wide range of phenomena. I'm mainly going to concentrate on the short-term presentiment, but I'll say something about precognitive dreams to start with and premonitions. Ever through recorded history, people have mentioned the fact that some people dream of things that happen in the future. And this has been studied scientifically for about 100 years now. The classic study was a book by J.W. Dunn, a British aeronautical engineer, published in the 1920s, called An Experiment with Time. It's still in print. Dunn, who was serving in the army in South Africa, noticed that his ability to dream things that hadn't yet happened seemed to be happening quite often. He started dreaming about things, then they happened, and then at first he thought it was a false memory of the dreams, so he systematically recorded his dreams. And then he found that he was quite often, several times a week, dreaming about things that hadn't yet happened. Sometimes they were newspaper headlines, sometimes they were fairly trivial events. And he became convinced that our dreams often contain elements from the future as well as memories from the past and other elements that we can't actually identify. He persuaded several friends to do this too, and they also found they were dreaming about things that hadn't yet happened. In his book, he tells you that you won't believe him unless you try it yourself. And so I tried it myself, writing my dreams down, and sure enough, I soon experienced things that hadn't yet happened. In one dream, for example, I dreamt that I was in a room with a number of friends, and there was somebody who came into the room with a needle and was going around the room trying to inject people. And I found it very sinister, and it was a disturbing dream. I interpreted it as trying to inject people with heroin or something like that. Two or three days later, I was at a friend's birthday party in South London. And what was happening was that suddenly, in the middle of the party, someone came in with an ear-piercing device, which had a shiny needle on it, and went round the room offering to pierce people's ears. Well, I hadn't dreamt exactly about an ear-piercing device, but as John Dunn says, what you do is write down the visual impressions, and the visual impression was one of somebody coming in with a needle trying to pierce people, and that's what happened. I had quite a number of other striking examples, so many that I was convinced this is real, and undoubtedly, if you haven't experienced this yourself, you'll doubt that it's possible or that it's real. But read Dunn's book and follow his method, and I think you'll find that you do have precognitive dreams. We don't normally remember them because we don't normally remember most of our dreams anyway. There are many records of people dreaming of disasters in advance. And when the 9/11 disaster struck New York with the collapse of the World Trade Centers, I thought this would be a great opportunity for looking for precognitive dreams. I put out appeals for information in New York soon afterwards, and I got over 75 reports of precognitive dreams. In some cases, people didn't go to work as a result of their dream, or other intuitions, and so their lives were saved. In other cases, people dreamed of jet planes crashing into skyscrapers, not necessarily the World Trade Center, but sometimes other tall buildings in New York or even in Chicago. So it wasn't specific to that, but it was images of planes crashing into tall buildings. In other cases, people dreamed of being trapped inside burning skyscrapers and buildings collapsing. In others, they dreamed of clouds of dust rolling down the streets with a terrible sense of foreboding. Well, these were all different images of the disaster of the World Trade Center collapse. And I think that many of them were precognitive dreams. In some cases, people told friends or family members about them before the dramatic collision of the jet planes with the World Trade Center and its collapse. So there's additional evidence that these were not just made up afterwards. So I think there's good evidence precognitive dreaming can actually happen. How we explain this is another question. I'll come back to possible explanations at the end of this talk. There are also premonitions where people have feelings or forebodings of something that's going to happen. And animals are actually rather better at this than people. Again, ever since ancient times, there have been reports of animals behaving strangely days or hours before earthquakes. And I've been tracking animal behavior before earthquakes over the last 30 years. And in many cases, I've been able to find out soon after the earthquake about unusual animal behavior. For example, in the 1997 Assisi earthquake in Italy, I had had at the time an Italian research assistant, and within 2 days she was in Assisi interviewing people like the mayor and newspaper reporters, restaurant proprietors, zookeepers, vets, and other people about unusual animal behavior. Several days before the Assisi earthquake, rats came out of their holes and were swarming over terraces of restaurants, causing alarm among people eating there. The restaurant proprietors complained to the mayor about this. No one knew why it had happened. And then the earthquake struck. Unusual howling of dogs in the night for a night or two before this happened. And other examples of unusual animal behavior. In the 1970s, the Chinese, under Chairman Mao, had a project for earthquake warnings by asking peasants and workers to report unusual animal behavior. And as a result of it, they were able to evacuate entire cities before devastating earthquakes struck. These animal warning system, together with other traditional folklore-type wisdom about what might happen, changes in wells, unusual behavior in springs, and so on, together gave earthquake warnings, whereas modern seismologists, with all their fancy apparatus, can't do this. Well, animals can also give warnings of tsunamis. And before the December the 26, 2004 tsunami, there were many reports of animals moving away from coastal areas in Sri Lanka and South India and Indonesia and in other places affected by the tsunami. Again, I collected stories from those parts of the world and found many examples of elephants, monkeys, other animals, nesting flamingos, going away from their coastal nesting sites before these tsunamis struck. Now, doing research on these phenomena is complicated by the fact you can't actually predict very far in advance when tsunamis and earthquakes are going to happen, and in fact, animals give the best prediction available. So you just have to wait and see what would happen. And there haven't been many scientifically documented studies. One unusual one happened in Italy a few years ago when there was a major quake in Italy. An Oxford zoology student, a graduate student, was doing a study on the mating of toads in a lake. And she was documenting day by day how the toads came to the lake to mate. And then in the middle of the mating season, for several days, there were no toads. This had never been observed before. It was very surprising and puzzling. She told her supervisor at Oxford University, the records clearly show there were no toads. And then the quake struck. So here's, and they didn't start mating again until several days afterwards. So here's a particularly clear-cut example where there was continuous observation going on, showing this change in behaviour. Not only earthquakes and tsunamis lead to animals picking up that something is going to happen, but also avalanches. I did a study with the help of a Swiss friend, Theo Itten, who carried out surveys in Switzerland and Austria in relation to avalanches. And there it's common knowledge that animals behave strangely soon before an avalanche and in effect give warnings of avalanches. So that's another kind of natural disaster which leads to animal premonitions. They also happen before man-made disasters like bombing raids in wars. And in the Second World War, I've received many reports of people in Britain who were alerted to when there was going to be a bombing raid, long before the air raid sirens went off, because their animals behaved strangely or behaved in such a way as to indicate to them that the raid was about to happen. The animals gave warnings an hour or two in advance. The air raid sirens were usually much sooner before the air raid than that. And you might think, well, they just heard the bomber planes coming. But actually, they couldn't have heard them an hour or two in advance. They would have been too far away. And also, there were many planes in the sky. They wouldn't have known if they heard a plane that was 2 hours flying time away that it was going to bomb their particular town or city. So this seemed to be a premonition of an actual bombing raid locally near where they were. I received many of these stories from people in Britain, which I collected about 20 years ago, when there were still many people alive who remembered the war. And then I did a similar collection of stories in Germany and found very similar kinds of stories. I'll just give one example of a warning. Well, two examples, actually. They're both very good ones. And this is from a German woman called Dagmar Kessel, who had a parrot, or at least her friends did. During the wartime year of 1943, I stayed with acquaintances in Leipzig. They had an old parrot. Suddenly, about 9 p.m., it was extremely upset in its cage, lifted its left wing, and called, da oben, up there. It even looked up, and nobody could get it quiet. I was surprised and asked my host what it was all about. He always does that before an air alert, the lady said. Usually 2 hours in advance. That same night the Tommies really came. They destroyed the Crystal Palace. So that's one example. Another example from Germany is one of the most moving of these stories, because it is so sad in a way, but amusing in another way. An Austrian sculptor, Heinz Petteri, was arrested during the war for his undiplomatic words and deported to Bochum in the Ruhr to defuse unexploded bombs. He lived in a small room in the tower of the police administration building. From his window, he used to watch the pigeons that lived on the roofs, and he noticed that the birds often flew away suddenly, all of them, and half an hour later, at the most, the bombers came. Afterwards, the birds came back. This was repeated many times. He used this knowledge to warn his comrades and superiors of impending raids, and his predictions repeatedly proved to be accurate. But when the Gestapo heard about it, he was arrested once again under suspicion of being a spy in contact with the enemy. These are, and this is all discussed in my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, which deals with telepathy, premonitions and the sense of direction, three major areas of unexplained animal behaviour. This kind of thing has happened more recently during the NATO bombing raids on Serbia in 1999. Animals in the Belgrade Zoo were behaving very strangely, well in advance of the bombing raids, long before they could have heard planes coming. So this seems to be a fairly widespread form of behaviour. There are also many examples of animals that give warnings of impending disasters to their owners. In one case, a woman was about to go out to work as usual one morning, and for some reason her dog just wouldn't let her go. It kept barring the way, tried to stop her leaving the house. And she left anyway, and soon afterwards was involved in a very bad car crash. In another case, a woman was riding a horse and it refused to go through a gateway, and it absolutely refused to move. And shortly afterwards, a large branch of a tree fell off, which would have hit them if they had gone ahead as she'd intended. There are also many examples of animals that give warnings of medical problems. The best known and best documented is with epileptic seizures. Many people who suffer from seizures find their life very curtailed because they don't want to be out and about in a public place when they're overcome with an epileptic seizure. And some people who have that problem have seizure alert dogs, specially trained dogs, that give them warnings up to half an hour in advance before the onset of a seizure. Typically, the dogs will herd them to a safe place and get them to sit down or lie down and then sit and keep guard over them. Some dogs do this spontaneously, but there are some charities which now train seizure alert dogs, and they make a huge difference to the lives of people with epilepsy. Again, nobody knows how they do it. If it was just a simple matter of twitches in the body or even electrical signals from the brain, it would be possible to develop a seizure alert device. But nobody's yet found out how they do it, and I suspect it's another form of premonition or precognition. Now, when we turn to human presentiment, this has been studied by parapsychologists like Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And what this shows is a short-term, very short-term, over a matter of seconds, of changes in physiological state before some emotionally arousing event. And this is called presentiment, or feeling the future. In Dean Radin's experiments, subjects sit in front of a computer and pictures come up on the screen at intervals. When they feel relaxed and ready, they press a start button. And then after about 10 seconds, the computer selects from a large pool of photographs and pictures a picture at random, which then appears on the screen in front of the subject. Meanwhile, they're being monitored for emotional arousal by electrodermal skin response with electrodes attached to their fingers, like in a lie detector. This measures emotional arousal. When you're emotionally aroused, there's more adrenaline, you sweat, and that changes the skin conductance. So it's a very sensitive way of measuring emotional arousal. Now, not surprisingly, when people are shown emotionally arousing pictures, either hardcore pornography or scenes of extreme violence, they're emotionally aroused. This is well known. It's been studied by psychologists for a long time. It's not surprising. But what Dean Radin and his colleagues found is that this emotional arousal begins at least 5 seconds, and in some cases up to 15 seconds, before the stimulus appears on the screen. And this is compared with control periods when the picture that appears on the screen is not emotionally arousing. Vaguely pleasant landscapes or neutral pictures don't bring about this effect. It's brought about by emotional arousal. This is statistically significant. It's been replicated in many other labs. And I can show you an average from about 20 or 30 subjects, which is from Dean Radin's research. What you see here is the period in the middle between the two lines is when this picture is being shown on the screen. The dark marks represent the response, the electrodermal response, when it's an emotional picture that's being shown. As you can see, after the picture's been shown, there's quite a big emotional arousal. For calm pictures, which are not arousing, which are the unfilled, the open circles, the response just falls off and doesn't show any particular effect other than a gradual decline after the picture's been shown. But if you look at the period before, you'll see that before the emotional picture, there's a very significant difference in arousal as measured by the electrodermal response compared with the control. This can't possibly be because they picked this information up by any normal means. The picture was selected at random by the computer a millisecond before it appeared on the screen, so nobody in the world knew it was going to be an emotional one as opposed to a non-emotional picture. And yet they were responding. It's as if the emotion had a kind of pre-echo before the emotional arousal. They were already getting emotionally aroused. Now, one of Radin's colleagues replicated this work, Professor Dick Biermann at Amsterdam, at the Free University of Amsterdam. And he invited me to be a subject in some of these experiments. And I was very happy to see what it was like for myself. I was completely unaware, consciously, of what kind of picture was going to appear. But during this test, I did notice that the violent images had very little effect on me. I think that's partly because, as a biology student, I did a lot of dissection. And for some reason, the pictures they showed, they didn't affect me, but the erotic images certainly did. And the result of my experiment with Dick Biermann is shown here in this graph. And what you see here is the in the middle of it, where the stimulus is a black line with an arrow showing when the picture was shown. The blue diamonds with the calm pictures, the control, and you see there's not much change. It falls off a bit after the stimulus has been shown. The yellow ones are the violent pictures, which again showed very little effect. But the red are the erotic ones. And as you'll see, the erotic response occurred very significantly before the stimulus was shown. The electrodermal response was very significantly different from that in the controls. So just in this particular experiment, with just me as a subject, it already shows this effect. You don't need hundreds and hundreds of subjects. This was a clear-cut effect with just one subject, me, with no previous training or anything like that. So I'm pretty convinced myself, especially having taken part in this experiment, that this is a real phenomenon. There is a kind of pre-echo of emotional arousal. This could play a role in all sorts of real-life situations. For example, if you were a jet pilot and you were flying along supersonic speed, you've got very little time to react to an impending disaster. And say you were suddenly being approached by some other plane flying towards you, you had to react suddenly. That would be very emotionally arousing. And if this effect cut in, it would prepare you for that several seconds in advance. You'd be much more concentrated. You'd be much more able to deal with it. If you were skiing downhill and you went round a corner and there was suddenly an obstacle in the way, you'd have to react extremely fast. And this presentiment effect could prepare you to do that by preparing your emotions for this emotionally arousing situation you're about to enter into. So I think that this presentiment is a real phenomenon. It's been shown in laboratory experiments, I think, conclusively. But what I'm interested in is how it affects real life and how we might come across this in real life. And one situation in which I think it occurs is through waking before alarms. Most people have had the experience of waking soon before an alarm clock goes off. And I've had it myself. I set an alarm for a particular time and I wake a minute or two before the alarm goes off. Now, I've done surveys on this. I did an internet-based survey with hundreds of people. And the first question I asked is, have you ever woken soon before an alarm went off? Yes, no. Yes was 97%. Now, you could argue this is just a biological clock and this is a routine response and it's just at routine times because of habit and so on. But actually, I know from my own experience that when I'm travelling, I've got to get up early to catch an early flight. I've got jet lag. Nothing's routine about that situation, and yet the same thing still happens. So the next question I asked is, if yes, has this happened only at routine times or also at non-routine times? And 80% of people said that this had happened at non-routine times. So I think this is a very, very common phenomenon. Now, most people don't think about it at all. They just assume that this is some kind of biological clock, a time sense that enables us to know what the time is. But I don't think it's as simple as that. First of all, most people's time sense isn't very good. I've done experiments where I interrupt people at different times of the day and ask them to say what time it is without any warning. And even though during the day we have chances to look at watches and phones and computers and clocks on the wall, we're constantly being told the time or hear it on the radio, most people are wildly inaccurate. I mean, they can be wrong by 15 minutes, half an hour or more during the day. I have a more accurate time sense than most because I don't wear a watch. I have a pocket watch. And for some years I didn't even have a pocket watch or any other means of telling the time. And I got quite good at estimating the time, better than most people. But even so, it wasn't with that kind of pinpoint accuracy that seems to occur with alarm clocks. So the other reason I think that this is not just a time sense is there's nothing in our evolutionary history that would prepare us for this. Most humans have only had clocks or watches since the 20th century, and even before that, the number of people with clocks was fairly small. There were church clocks, of course, in public places since the Middle Ages, but they weren't particularly accurate. And most people didn't have to have a very good time sense. If you were a farmer, you woke up with a cock crow, and you worked with the daylight, and your hours change through the year because of daylight and natural suns. But the invention of railways and the need for railway timetables led to the standardisation of time throughout Britain and other countries. Before that, there wasn't a really standardised time. Now it's standardised through radio signals and electronic signals, almost everyone has a clock or a watch because our life is extremely ordered in terms of time, airline schedules, train schedules, punctuality of meeting at meetings and so on. But this is all very recent. And I don't think there's anything in our evolutionary history that would prepare us to have this kind of extremely sensitive time sense when we're asleep. However, one thing that would have evolved over time is the ability to wake before some disaster occurs. Animals are at their most vulnerable when they're asleep. And say there's some attack about to happen, or some predator about to attack, or some disaster about to happen when you're asleep, the ability to have a presentiment of that disaster and wake up a bit before the disaster would be extremely advantageous in evolutionary terms. It would help survival. And in fact, when you think about it, the word alarm, as in alarm clock or alarm on a phone, comes from the Italian word allarme, to arms. It's an emergency response that is being invoked. And so I think that alarm clocks are actually triggering off an actual alarm response, a presentiment response. And I think that's why so many people are waking before alarms. Now, this is a testable possibility. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that some people say that they don't actually need to set the alarm. They'll wake up anyway. They can decide to wake up at, say, 6:10 a.m., and they'll wake up at 6:09 or so before the alarm would have gone off if they had an alarm. I think in that case, what they're doing is having a presentiment of the time when they wake up. I think they're actually looking, when they look at the time they wake up, that gives that, it's a presentiment of that time that wakes them up. I would predict that if you withdrew all clocks and watches so they couldn't look at the time when they woke up, their accuracy would decline, and this is a testable prediction. But the best way to test whether or not waking before alarms is a presentiment effect, or whether it's a biological clock effect, is to look at unexpected alarms. And I've been doing surveys of people asking whether they've woken before unexpected alarms, like the phone going off, or like a fire alarm, or like some other alarm that's going to wake them up. And many people have. Between 66 and 80% of my respondents say that they have woken before unexpected alarms. And one of the most interesting stories among the stories I've collected came from a fireman in the United States who said that he and his colleagues slept at the fire station waiting for alarms. And he got to the point where he would just wake a minute or two before an alarm went off. And he'd already sat up in, from his bed where he was sleeping and got his boots on when the alarm went off. And those were quite unpredictable alarms. So this could give rise to an experiment to test for presentiment. The most obvious experiment is waking before an unexpected alarm goes off in the night, which is programmed by the experimenter on some kind of randomizing basis. You won't be surprised to know that I found very few volunteers for this. I did have one volunteer, a German graduate student. I arranged for random phone calls to wake him in the night that he didn't know about. He didn't know when they would be in advance. And after two or three nights, he said that this was proving very difficult. His girlfriend had now made him sleep on a sofa in a separate room. And after another two or three nights, he said this was just interfering too much with his lifestyle and his he just couldn't do it anymore. That was not an ideal test situation. It may be possible to persuade people to do this, but I think one might also be able to do this during the day if there's some sudden alarm goes off on a phone. And people can monitor, many people wear Fitbits and other monitoring devices, which would enable the response to be tracked without people being in labs with fancy apparatus. So I think that waking before alarms can actually be tested experimentally, And I think it would be a very revealing experiment. I think it would suggest that we have this ability, that it's something that we've inherited through our evolutionary past. And it's something that could actually be trained. If, for example, in driving simulators or flight simulators, when people are being trained as racing car drivers or as pilots, they're trained to become more aware of these feelings. They could even have a red light that flashes on that's activated by a physiological response that's being monitored in their own body, so they're more attentive when a potential accident or danger arises. Well, that's one way in which presentiment could be tested and may affect normal life. Another area where it becomes a possibility of actually making money is in day trading. In day trading on the stock market, people are punting on whether or not a stock is on a graph going like this, and the actual value from moment to moment, second to second, the value of stocks, shares, bonds, etc., is fluctuating depending on what's happening in stock markets. And this is all online data. And day traders are making guesses about whether a stock will go up or down in value over the next few seconds. They can't possibly know on the basis of studying the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal or company financial reports what fluctuations are going to happen on a second-by-second basis. They might be able to predict through rational means over months or years, which is what traditional stockbrokers and investors do. But day trading is something very, very much more short-term. I was invited by one of the leading day trading companies in London to visit their trading floor because the head of the firm had been to a talk of mine and was interested in my work. I gave a talk, in fact, to the whole day trading team, and in return I asked them to explain to me exactly what's going on. And there were these people, some of them with eight different screens, all tracking different aspects of the market, German bond futures, tin on the Kuala Lumpur tin exchange, and so on. All around the world, there were these graphs going like this. And then there were TV screens up all along the roof with live feeds of news from all over the world. And so I asked for a demo, and he said, OK, here we are, let's take German government bond futures. And here's this graph going up. He said, let's put 1,000 euros on this and put in the amount. And he said, do you think it's going to go up or down? And where might it go? And so I said, well, I think it'll go up to there. And then the graph went, and it went up. He said, you've just made 5,000 euros. So, of course, you can also lose 5,000 euros just as fast. Now, people who are doing this are doing it very successfully. And when I asked, how do you pay the staff? He said, our trainees get 10% of the profits and our most experienced traders get 80% of the profits. And I said, well, what if they don't make profits? He said, then they don't get anything. So there's an incredibly powerful natural selection working on these trading floors and among amateur day traders working at home on their computers, because they could easily make a large loss. And in a company like that, if they lose more than they win, they have no money. They're out of a job. So the successful ones are ones who are able to do this successfully over months and years of, on average, making money, and some of them making millions. Now, what's really going on? I actually asked whether they thought it was presentiment, and they'd never heard of presentiment. They just thought that the people who were good at it were good at it. And I talked to the person who was best at it. He was a Greek Cypriot who'd been in London for quite a long time. And I asked him what happened, and he said, well, he said, I just somehow know when there's a news feed about to break some story that's relevant. Just happened to be watching that screen, and when I'm working, he said, I just feel drawn to the one where there's going to be movement, and I just seem to know which way it's going to go. All of this looks to me very like presentiment, a highly trained and highly refined form of presentiment. And I think that it's in stock markets, on day trading on stock markets, that we probably find the most skillful people with this ability, who've developed it, as I say, by a very strong form of natural selection. Now, it would be possible to test this, and my idea, which could make a lot of money for somebody, you won't be able to patent it because I'm now disclosing it and putting it in the public domain for free because I really want someone to do it, is to have a day trading training app where you have live feeds from the actual markets and you guess whether it's going to go up or down, and you do all the things day traders do, but you do it with fake money, I mean imaginary money. Everyone who starts doing on this trading app would say be given £500,000, imaginary £500,000, and then see how they get on. Now, I've already talked to day trading companies in the City of London. They think this is a great idea. If people are consistently making millions of imaginary money, it shows they have what's necessary to do this successfully. And one of them even suggested that there could be a world competition for people with these day trading apps. And the ones who won it would get free internships at their company in the City of London. It would save them losing lots of money by taking on trainees, most of whom lose money during their first year. They only keep 1 out of 10 trainees every year, and many of them lose money and the company loses that money because they have to cover the losses for trainees. This way they could take on people who've actually trained themselves or who have a natural ability to do this. So a day trading app, I think, would work really well. It would be quite easy to develop the app. Personally, for research purposes, I'd be interested to know whether there's any difference in performance when it's a live feed of an actual stock market share or stock or bond or commodity compared with a historical record from, say, last year or 5 years ago. There wouldn't be any kind of buzz around that in the whole atmosphere because it's a purely historic thing. No one else would be doing it. Or a simulated graph, which is based on random changes. Would it work better with live streams, historical ones, or random changes? It's possible, as a pre-sentiment effect, it would work equally with all three. But there might be some extra boost from the live streams because so many minds are engaged and some kind of electric buzz around that in real time. I dare say that people could make training apps and charge people a lot of money for training on them, because anyone who really did train this skill really could make millions. Well, you might think, well, what about betting? What about online gambling? Why don't people make millions there? And in fact, this is one of the arguments sceptics often raise against the reality of phenomena like presentiment. They say, well, if this is such a great thing, why don't people make millions? Well, the answer is, on the stock market they do, but with online betting or with casinos they don't, because the casinos and the online betting people have algorithms to spot people who are consistently winning, and they then either ban them from their site or reduce the stake they're allowed to bet to £1 or something very, very small. And then the people then re-register under a different name, and the algorithms try and catch them and ban them before they can cause the company to lose any money. With stock markets, there's no restraint. With betting companies, they're stacking the odds against people with this ability deliberately, otherwise they'd go out of business. These are areas of research that are very little explored, and basically there are three kinds of experiments that I think what I've talked about could suggest. First is an app to track, to predict earthquakes based on animal behaviour. It would be possible to develop an app which anywhere in the world could use. Obviously, people in earthquake-prone areas would be more interested. If they see unusual animal behaviour, they just put it in the app with one or two details, make it very simple. Then, using something like Google Maps, if there were suddenly lots of reports from near Lahore, Pakistan, or near Thessaloniki in Greece, or somewhere else in the world, the map could sort of glow red, as it were, and more intense, depending on the number of reports. And these could actually be used as the basis of an animal-based earthquake warning system, using existing technologies, an app on existing smartphones. Secondly, there could be tests to see whether people respond before alarms, as I mentioned, either when they're asleep or when they're awake. And these could employ apps that depend on Fitbits or other monitoring systems that many people are wearing anyway. And thirdly, there could be a training app for day trading, which could enable people to make millions of pounds, dollars, or any other currency. So there's a way forward scientifically. But then, of course, there's the question, how does this work? And the answer to that is nobody knows. One possibility which some people who are into quantum theory talk about is that in quantum theory it's possible to interpret some changes as causation working backwards in time, retrocausation. And, of course, as soon as you talk about retrocausation, you get into a realm of science fiction. There are many science fiction stories that imagine what could happen if you could reverse the order of causation. You could intervene in the past and change the course of history, and so on. Personally, I think those are of moderate interest, but not really that much interest, because I don't think we can reduce consciousness to quantum phenomena. That's an ultimate reduction, to reduce a highly complex system to something that the smallest possible units of change in physics. Well, so quantum is the smallest possible unit of change. It's sort of ultimate reductionism. Another possibility, which I myself am interested in and think more plausible, is that the present is not a finely defined slice. Our minds are not working in the present in terms of a microsecond or a nanosecond. The fact that a cinema works when you see a series of what are essentially still frames, and when you see them projected in the cinema, it looks like continuous motion, is because our presence are extended in time. They're not an instantaneous slice. There's a spread. And the spread in measuring people's physiological responses to sounds and their conscious responses shows that there can be up to 500 milliseconds, half a second, before you notice something. The present seems to be spread out in many perceptual phenomena at least 500 milliseconds. But what if the present for certain events is spread out over hours or days? Everything in nature is made of wave-like patterns. A day and a night is a kind of oscillating rhythm of light and dark. It's a kind of wave. And no wave can occur at an instant. A wave takes time to wave, and the wavelength could be milliseconds or days or even years. And the present, therefore, may be spread out over a particular wave. And if it's spread out, there's no reason to believe that all the spread out would be in the past, that there'd be a wave spread out, and then you get to the present. There's an instant cutoff at this point. Here's the present. If the wave spread out through the present, then the future would be part of the wave as well as the past. And so what appears to come from the future, as in presentiment or a precognitive dream, may be part of a kind of extended present. Well, that's just a speculation, and you may think it's just playing with words. But personally, I'm not that bothered about what explanation we prefer. I think the most important thing is to find out whether these phenomena actually happen, which most people believe they do because they've experienced them, but which dogmatic skeptics say they can't because they go against their conception of nature through mechanistic science. So I think it's much more important to carry out the empirical research and find out what's happening and also how we can apply it. And then if it's clear to everyone that these things are real, a lot of theoreticians are going to want to try and find explanations. But I think it's better to find the explanations afterwards when we've got more facts than delay examining the facts because we don't have an explanation in advance. So this is an open question, and here are ways in which the question can be answered experimentally through animals and earthquake prediction, through arousal before alarms or other arousing stimuli, and through stock market day trading apps that, if successful, would enable people to make lots of money, which for many people would be the ultimate proof of something's reality.